It's The World This Week. The World This Week in partnership with The Daily Beast. Daily Beast World Editor Nico Hines graces us with his presence from London. How are you? Also with us is Steve Erlinger, Brussels Bureau Chief for The New York Times. Thanks for joining us. How are you?
I'm fine, Brussels. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you. Nice to see Matthew Dalton, Paris-based reporter for The Wall Street Journal.
Nice to see you, Francois.
Busy week?
Really busy.
Really busy. All right.
A lot of submarines.
Joining us from that hardship post they call Saint-Tropez, Dana Thomas, author of Fashionopolis, The Price of Fast Fashion, and The Future of Clothes. How have you been?
Great. Lovely to see you.
All right. The World This Week on Facebook and Twitter, hashtag World This Week. A stab in the back, a breach of trust, France's foreign minister fuming after Australia's surprise dumping of a deal for 12 French diesel-powered battle-ready submarines in favor of a new three-way defense partnership with the U.S. and U.K., along with Washington providing the technology for 8 nuclear-powered subs.
I'm really angry. What worries me is the behavior of the Americans. This unilateral, brutal, unpredictable decision looks a lot like what Mr. Trump used to do.
Those are fighting words. Interesting when you see the anger of the French foreign minister. We should tell our viewers, Matthew Dalton, he's one of these political survivors because in a previous life, he was the defense minister, Jean-Yves Le Drian. He's been in government a long time.
Right. He negotiated this agreement for President Hollande, Emmanuel Macron's predecessor, as defense minister. Then he became the foreign minister. This was a huge deal. It's called the Contract of the Century by the French media. It's worth tens of billions of dollars in the coming decades. It's also part of a greater vision that France has for projecting its influence, also European influence, in the Indo-Pacific as part of a bulwark against China. It was sort of a big play by France to be a kind of player on the global stage in the Asia-Pacific region. So this was a big strategic contract for France, for its industry. And the fact that the U.S. swept in and apparently with just a few months of negotiations behind the scenes, behind their back negotiations.
You went earlier to a briefing at the foreign ministry. Were they really that surprised?
They were really surprised. So the French say that...
Really surprised.
They were really surprised. I mean, the French say that the Australian Prime Minister... Morrison brought this up at a meeting with Macron back in June when they had dinner, that he had some concerns about the contract, nothing existential that would call into question the actual future of the contract. They had numerous, so the French took that as a, you know, potential alarm.
Let's listen to Scott Morrison, because to hear the Prime Minister of Australia tell it, he kept Emmanuel Macron in the loop.
Yeah, well, we've been speaking for some time, and I had dinner with him back in Paris, back in late June, and we talked about these very issues and the serious situation that Australia was facing and the needs that we would have and the challenges that presented with that submarine program. So I understand they're disappointed, and that's very, very clear, and we'll work through those issues.
But the French press points instead to an August 30th Franco-Australian meeting. That's less than 3 weeks ago, with an official communique out of Paris that seemed happily oblivious to the trouble ahead. In this virtual sit-down, you had the foreign and defense ministers from both countries saying they were committing to strengthening cooperation, underpinning the importance of the future submarine program. Steve Erlinger, someone's telling pies.
We'll hear what they want to hear. I'm sure you've experienced this, Francois, yourself. I think the contract was in trouble. I think the French knew it was in trouble, but I also understand why they're so angry. Why Le Drian, who is a very nice, calm guy generally, was so énervé, you know, because honestly, it's a humiliation for France. It's a blow to its notion of global France, if I can say that. And it looks like the perfidious Albion has stolen a march. Now, the issue from the American point of view is the Australians were unhappy. The Australians came to the Brits. The Brits came to the Americans. Basically, Australia, I think, facing a new China, this Xi Jinping's China is not the Xi Jinping China of 5 years ago or 6 years ago. A counterweight involving the Americans, also the Brits, but basically the Americans, matters more. It's a bigger symbolic.
Here's the bit I don't understand. The only other Western presence in the Pacific besides the U.S. is France. It's got a navy that's well deployed.
Yes, but I mean, this is, you know, part of the question, which is the Americans actually are allies of the French in the Indo-Pacific, in the Sahel, in NATO, in lots of places, right? But the Americans do not want to share nuclear propulsion technology with the French. So they limited it to Five Eyes. Now, why the Australians did this, you'll have to ask the Australians. But the Americans feel they were helping an ally when they were asked. It wasn't their idea. And they've got, again, emotions are obviously very high. I think the other thing France has to be careful about is trying to turn this into leverage for strategic autonomy inside Europe, because there are a lot of Europeans, quite honestly, who see this as a bilateral French problem, not a European Union problem. But we'll see. It feeds on Afghanistan. It feeds on the sense that the Biden administration may not be as competent as we all hoped, but also that it's not much different, that what Macron describes as the strategic shift of America going back to Obama and even before, certainly through Trump, which is America spending less time worrying about its allies and more time worrying about its own interests, that narrative will gain strength.
All right. And there's something else that stings for the French. Le Monde reporting that the new alliance and all it implies was brought up in a three-way side meeting at the June G7 summit in Cornwall back in June, all the more humiliating that France's President Emmanuel Macron was probably in the next room when these pictures were taken. On Thursday in the House of Commons, Boris Johnson insisting France is still a vital defense ally. However,
this is, AUKUS is not intended to be adversarial towards any other power, Mr. Speaker, but it merely reflects the close relationship that we have with the United States and with Australia, the shared values that we have, and the sheer level of trust between us that enables us to go to this extraordinary extent of sharing nuclear technology.
So let's see, Nico Hines. Shared values, sheer level of trust. Is there not a shared values and sheer level of trust with the French?
Well, I think in a word, no. Britain and Australia does have a huge record of sharing everything. And this Five Eyes thing, you know, something I've looked into a bit that's been going on for almost 100 years, not always called Five Eyes, but the idea of sharing intelligence between Canada, Australia, the US, is something that's so firmly embedded within these intelligence agencies that there really is no way that these countries like the US or Britain would share their very top level technologies with anybody outside of that small group. And as much as the French are stomping and kicking their feet, the fact is that it's just never going to happen.
And the UK, you could say the big winners of this new alliance.
Absolutely. Just when it looked like Britain had been kicked out of every important club going, finally, Boris Johnson's luck has come in again. And let's be under no mistake, Boris Johnson is not the architect of this. He's not the genius behind it. This is something that just seems to have happened. And once again, suddenly Britain is back in the kind of top echelon of the clubs where it wants to be. And you know, as you were talking about before, the French in the Indo-Pacific, sure, they are there. But there's only one superpower over there, apart from China, and that's the United States. And that's the team that everybody wants to back them, even if the French are suggesting that Biden is just Trump Mark II.
Dana Thomas, we talk about, you know, the old rivalries between France and the English-speaking world. We think of it often as something of the past, right? Except for when there's rugby on. And that, you know, we have a English-speaking president who happily does so now. We thought it was a... Is this a turning point? Are we going back to those days?
I think already Brexit kind of brought us back to those days. And yes, the roast beefs versus the frogs, definitely. You know, this was a big hit for the French. The one thing they know how to do well is build submarines. Not a lot of countries do. So that was already, you know, a hard hit. But then it fell on the anniversary of Havre de Grace, the big battle in the Chesapeake Bay, the last great battle of Lafayette. And, you know, so it was like a 1-2 punch for the French. And you know, and the British delivered it again. Thank you very much.
The British delivered it.
Yeah, I mean, no, they didn't, but they certainly feels like they did, right? Everyone's got their knickers in a twist, as the Brits say.
Matthew Dalton, of course, it's not just France that's upset over this new AU. I suppose we're supposed to pronounce it AUKUS, Australia, UK, AUKUS, US AUKUS alliance. Let's hear from Beijing on this.
The relevant countries should abandon their zero-sum thinking from the Cold War and instead narrow geopolitical concepts, respect the wishes of the people in the region, and do more things that can lead to regional peace, stability, and development. Otherwise, they'll shoot themselves in the foot.
Well, Beijing's concern here is that this is a potential nuclear non-proliferation issue, because these are nuclear submarines, nuclear propelled submarines. The U.S. Says these are not going to have nuclear weapons, but it's a fact that submarines that do have nuclear propulsion, they can stay out at sea for much longer. They can go pretty much indefinitely from a fuel standpoint. They are more suitable to carrying nuclear weapons. So China looks at this, sees that, you know, that the U.S. has shared its nuclear capability with its transatlantic allies in Europe. At some point, does it, you know, share its nuclear capability with Australia?
Is it a point of no return? Because you remember the row between Australia and China when Scott Morrison talked about COVID originating inside of China. And, you know, this is a country, China amounts to what, 35% of Australia's total exports. So how much leverage do the Chinese have in all this?
Well, they have a lot of leverage, but I think Australia has realized that its relationship with China is potentially deteriorating to a point of no return. They've imposed all kinds of trade sanctions on the Australians in response to the COVID comments, in response to other things. So, yeah, this is Australia reading the writing on the wall and saying, maybe we do have to align ourselves with the other Asian superpower, the U.S., much more firmly. France is pretty distant. You know, they're not in the Pacific in the same way, obviously, that the U.S. is.
France is pretty distant. So is the rest of the European Union, you might argue. News of the alliance breaking the day of the publication of a long-planned Indo-Pacific policy paper by the European Union's foreign policy chief. The irony was not lost on Josep Borrell.
It is a good opportunity to recall, to reflect on the need to raise the issue of European strategic autonomy. It is more proof of the need to exist on our own.
So, Stephen Erlinger, earlier you said you're not sure that the rest of Europe shares this feeling of outrage that the French have right now. Listening to Josep Borrell, it sure sounds like it.
Well, Josep Borrell, as you may have understood, doesn't speak for the rest of Europe. In fact, one often wonders who he speaks for precisely, to be honest. He's a wonderful guy, a Spanish socialist who has different interests. And I think much more telling will be what happens in the German election, which is not really very far away, because if the French want, and I think everybody wants Europe to spend more on defense and be more capable. But as Ursula von der Leyen herself said Wednesday, it's not a matter of capacity, it's a matter of political will. So who will join the French in political will? Will the Germans do it? They're very reluctant. They've been very reluctant. Will the Poles join the French? They want to stay with the Americans. Will the Italians? I mean, this is part of the French problem. I think part of the worry in Paris, quite honestly, is to being isolated, to be left alone while Britain goes with America, and they're in a Europe which is not very militarily conscious. Do people want to spend 3-4% of GDP to create an autonomous European military? And to do what exactly? And to do what without the Americans? I mean, that's a real question. I mean, I'm not judging it, but that's the dilemma that Macron has. And if he asks too hard, he's going to drive the Germans away, which is his dilemma as he approaches his own re-election in April.
And just very briefly, Nico, before we go to the break, and we'll talk more about Germany afterwards, is this some kind of watershed moment, or will this pass?
What I found bizarre about this is how much France have seemed to want to turn this into a massive global story about how they've been humiliated. The only reason we're leading this program on this issue is because the French have had such strong words to say and have turned this into such a big row. Would we really have been covering some kind of military deal about submarines that were going to come into effect in 10, 15 years' time if there hadn't been this huge diplomatic spat? Yes, it still would have been a big story for people who were obsessively covering these things, but I think the French have turned this into a story all over the world about how they're no longer at the top table.
All right, we'll pick up on that when we come back. Stay with us. You're watching The World This Week. Welcome back, or welcome if you're just joining us. It's The World This Week, The World This Week in partnership with The Daily Beast. Nico Hines, Daily Beast World Editor, joins us from London. Welcome back as well to Steve Erlinger, Brussels Bureau Chief for The New York Times, Matthew Dalton, Paris-based reporter for The Wall Street Journal, and Dana Thomas is with us from Saint-Tropez on the French Riviera, the author of Fashionopolis, The Price of Fast Fashion, and the future of a close. The grumblings in France over that Indo-Pacific follow, we should say, the misgivings that we have seen in recent weeks over what NATO allies perceived as a rushed U.S.-led exit from Afghanistan. Now, defense was definitely on the menu as Emmanuel Macron Thursday evening hosted a farewell dinner for Germany's chancellor of 16 years, Angela Merkel, you might say also retiring as unofficial leader in Europe. We remember in particular, Matthew Dalton, during the Trump years, how she seemed to emerge. When you watch the optics of that dinner that took place on Thursday in the context of what we're discussing of where Europe stands, how replaceable or irreplaceable is Merkel at this point?
Well, I think de facto, the Chancellor of Germany is going to be the leader of Europe, and that was particularly true for Merkel during her tenure because she was there for the longest at a certain point. And, you know, there were issues, the biggest issues that she dealt with, the Eurozone crisis, for example, that was something where Germany held all the keys to the solution. They had the money. They held sway over the entire bloc. Nothing was going to happen without Germany's say so. So her position on that was absolutely crucial. And then, of course, during the migrant crisis, she kind of became the conscience of Europe in that particular moment. But at the same time, also aroused a lot of anger in other countries. So she's always been at the center of the biggest European debates since she's been chancellor. But that sort of comes with the territory of being the chancellor of Germany, the biggest economy in Europe, the most populous country in Europe. So clearly, whoever succeeds her is going to be absolutely crucial to where Europe goes in the future.
And it seems, for now at least, according to polls which have proved unreliable in the past, that the ticket to victory is to, well, the candidate that's the most like Muti. There's 9 days to go till the election. There was a candidates debate last Sunday. Right now, the latest debates have the Social Democrats ahead with the current finance minister, Olaf Scholz, leading the uncharismatic successor to Merkel as leader of the Christian Democrats, Armin Laschet. Kind of an odd campaign when the leader of the center-left poses on a magazine cover appropriating the Merkel trademark triangle hand pose. He's not from Merkel's party. What does that tell you, Dana Thomas?
Well, I think it's, I don't know. It's, I don't know.
It's incredible, though, 16 years with the same leader in Germany, and we're having trouble now imagining the country without her.
I know. But we go through that every time with a leader who's been in power for a long time. I remember when Mitterrand came after 14. Was Mitterrand president? Most of my lifetime, it seems. And when he left, we thought, how could the country carry on? I remember after 8 years when Reagan left, and we thought, how can the country carry on? It feels like a big hole is left. And you think, who can actually really replace them? You can't replace them. You just have to move on. If that's, you know, how we go onward and forward with new ideas and new people.
New ideas and new people. And we heard Matthew Dalton describing how the challenges of Europe, she's been at the center of dealing with them, everything from the financial crisis all the way to the COVID pandemic. And we saw with this Wednesday, the State of the EU speeches, Europhiles look to it as something important, a weather vane of how much Brussels matters, in this case, Strasbourg, since that's where the speech took place, a full house for Commission President Ursula von der Leyen's speech. However, let's perhaps not oversell it. Images of Competition Commissioner Margrethe Vestager knitting during the speech have emerged. What do those optics tell you, Steve Erlinger?
Well, they tell you that she likes to knit. She's always liked to knit. But she and Timmermans are both very powerful vice presidents who kind of run their own shows. I mean, part of the problem Ursula von der Leyen has had is she was kind of parachuted in, partly because of Emmanuel Macron, as a sort of compromise over probably better experienced European candidates, including those two. And there, it's a commission that's a bit divided. But everyone is definitely, without question, waiting to see who will emerge, what kind of government will emerge inside Germany. Because, of course, we're dragging ourselves toward this vote. Then we're going to drag ourselves through coalition negotiations, which are going to take weeks and weeks and weeks, because it's likely to be a three-party coalition. German friends say to me, it's going to go fast this time. We may have a government by Christmas. Well, Christmas feels a very long way away. Last time took 6 months. And if you have a chancellor, even if it's Scholz, who is a very decent guy from Hamburg, was a mayor of Hamburg, if he wins and if he's in some sort of coalition, he's going to be a very French-facing, pro-European guy. He's very close to Bruno Le Maire, for instance.
The finance minister. And let me just ask you on this, Steve, because it was a survey done by the European Council on Foreign Relations, the think tank, and they asked citizens across the EU, would you rather have a German or a French leader? And they all answered they preferred a German leader, and even the French preferred a German leader. Does that say more about Angela Merkel or Emmanuel Macron?
Well, I think it says something about both of them. I mean, Angela Merkel will be hard to replace, but, you know, no one will have her stature right away or her experience. And personally, she was very diligent. You know, she mastered her files. She was able to create compromise. There was a personal element as well as a German chancellor powerful element. The problem with Macron, everyone respects him, he's really smart, is he tends to have these big ideas and go marching off and look around and there's no one behind him. And what he has to learn to do, which I think everyone understands, even Clément Beaune, is to create alliances the way Merkel did to get things done. And one of the biggest alliances he's going to have to make is with the new German government. I think he would prefer Scholz. Laschet would be fine. Laschet's from Aachen, which is very close to France. They're both, you know, perfectly decent, rather boring people, and they are bound to have a sort of split government, which will seem very stable, but will have a very hard time if the chancellor party only gets 24-25%.
Which is what surveys are suggesting.
Exactly. Well, Angela Merkel used to get 40%.
Right.
So that makes a big difference. It's going to be a relatively weak German government that is going to have to compromise to create a coalition agreement. And then I think nothing much will change. Frankly.
All right. So the prospect of boring leaders in Germany, it's never boring at number 10 Downing Street. Boris Johnson chairing his first cabinet meeting this Friday since a major reshuffle this week by the British Prime Minister. Among those out, a gaffe-prone education minister. Among those demoted, Bojo's partner in crime during the 2016 Brexit campaign, Michael Gove. Kicked upstairs, a foreign secretary who insists that in no way did he play paddleball on the beach while staying on vacation when Kabul was falling. In Dominic Raab's place, conservative base party favorite Liz Truss. She rises from commerce and international trade to the foreign ministry. What's your takeaway, Nico Hines, from this reshuffle?
Well, people here are kind of saying that it's the Conservative Party getting ready for a new election. I can't believe that can be the case already, that we're going to go around again. Hopefully it shouldn't be until 2024 that there's another election here, but there could be one. Well, they're talking about getting rid of the Fixed Term Parliaments Act, which means that Boris Johnson could call an election at any moment. So we should all be kept on our toes. But it's definitely quite an aggressive reshuffle, and interesting to see that he's got rid of the two people that have had the most negative headlines in recent months. Dominic Raab, who, you know, clearly did the wrong thing by staying on his luxury holiday when he should have been trying to help the situation in Afghanistan. But you have to remember that he was told by his boss, Boris Johnson, that he was allowed to go on that holiday. And Boris Johnson was also on holiday at the same time while Afghanistan was falling into the hands of the Taliban. So it seems like you can cozy up to Boris Johnson, you can get a certain distance, but as soon as you become baggage, don't expect any loyalty.
And what's your feeling when you hear the rest of the panel talking about the intricacies of European politics? When you have this reshuffle this week, Nico, do you feel as though there really is Britain drifting further away from the continent?
Yeah, I think that's probably what the current government would like to think. And, you know, we've had stories this week about how pints are going to be allowed to be called pints again, which seems odd since pints of beer have always been called pints of beer all along, even though we were lashed to the terrors of Europe. But I do think that that's a narrative that this government is trying to portray and to continue, because they want to still run on that issue at the next election. But I think after that, so if we can look forward to the middle of the 2020s and beyond, I think then we'll probably settle into a more friendly system where we can be basically what we were before, which was kind of half in and half out.
All right. For now, it's definitely not half in, half out. There's plenty of regret over Brexit for many of Britain's flagship businesses. This week, that stealth weapon of British soft power, the food and clothing chain Marks and Spencer, closing 11 of its 20 stores here in France. M&S, as you can see from these images, unable to export enough of such British staples that Parisians secretly sneak, like cheddar cheese and curry dinners.
It's a pity because it's a shop that had very good products.
I had already noticed for some months that the shelves were short on stock and that a certain number of goods had unfortunately completely disappeared.
Dana Thomas, the writing was on the store shelf?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the gourmet grocery stores of Paris, but not just only, were as bare as old Mother Hubbard's cupboards for the first 6 months of this year. And then they worked it out a bit, and you could get some Fortnum & Mason tea and some digestives again. But, you know, the Marks & Spencer pullout is a big sign. And it's not just in the food business. It's also in the fashion business. You know, 42% of British luxury goods are exported to the EU. Designers are caught paying in fees. Their deliveries are late, and that costs a lot of money in the luxury fashion business, so much so that Paul Smith is talking about moving some of his production, what little there is in the UK, to Europe. So it's a bad sign for Britain's economy, and it's also a really bad sign for Paris, which has already got a blight right now of empty stores and of after COVID. I mean, every third store is empty or papered shut. And, you know, Madame Le Maire, she wants to run for president, that she couldn't somehow work this out so Marks & Spencer doesn't close that huge store next to the Apple store in the heart of Saint-Germain, leave it sitting empty, is a bad sign for her upcoming campaign.
A bad sign for upcoming campaign for now. Matthew Dalton, is that just temporary?
I'm just amazed. I think that this is a sign that the world has been turned upside down, where the French are complaining about the inability of Britain to export its food to France. It's amazing that French people really do like Marks and Spencer's. Like, and I'm American, but I love the peanut butter. I'm gonna be really upset.
Is it British peanut butter?
Apparently it is. Yeah, maybe it's not actually, you know, packaged in Britain.
Okay,
but I think. It's a blow for Paris. I mean, and a blow for the UK. I mean, a blow for the company. It's just, it's a completely self-inflicted wound, as a lot of critics of Brexit call the entire project. So, put another.
And it's about Brexit or it's about COVID?
Well, it seems, I mean, what I've been reading is that it's a lot of it is about, the tariffs that now face European exporters shipping to the EU. So I think it's, you know, when COVID is gone, Marks and Spencer's will not come back to France, it seems like.
Yeah, Nico Hines, at this point in time, again, I know that public opinion is traumatized where you are, but is there, you talked about us eventually getting to a point where Britain returns to its status of half in, half out. How hard is the pinch right now, and what do people feel about it?
It's actually really bad, and the shops here do have big empty shelves and notes up sort of saying things like, we're having some supply issues, we'll hope to get it sorted soon. What most of them are not saying is, it's because of Brexit, you idiot voters who voted for it. But that is kind of creeping in and becoming more of a kind of factor and permanent facet of our economy. And at the moment, I think because of COVID, because we're all in some sort of crisis world, we're wearing masks, we don't know what's going on, people haven't quite noticed the huge difference that Brexit is already making, but it will get worse and worse and worse. We can't fill our own grocery stores over here. I'm not surprised we couldn't fill our grocery stores in Paris.
All right, finally, the grocery store shelves, which are lacking Fortnum & Mason teas, there is, though, something to come and see here in Paris. From beyond the grave, the ultimate pinnacle of these two rag-to-riches artists, for the next 2 weeks, Paris's Arc de Triomphe, wrapped up according to the instructions of the late Christo and Marie-Jeanne, the pair who met in Paris in 1961 and started sketching the concept exactly 60 years ago. They have wrapped things all over the world. The French capitals, Pont-Neuf in the 1980s, the Berlin Reichstag in 1995, and now finally, the monument that's home to the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. Christo's nephew is Vladimir Yevovevich.
People can make out of it whatever they want and feel. Ultimately, Christo and Jean-Claude's work is about freedom. And this is an expression and a scream of freedom.
It's quite something to see an iconic monument all wrapped up, Matthew Dalton.
I haven't seen it yet. I really want to go see it. The pictures look very cool. And I'm glad they've wrapped it in recyclable plastic. So that's good. I think the next trick is just to make it completely disappear underneath that, like a David Copperfield magic trick.
Well, one of the conditions, Steve Erlinger, was to keep it open to the public because it's home to the tomb of the unknown soldier, and it's quite impressive to see that the workmen are on it permanently over the whole period. I was over there yesterday and today, and it changes according to the light. Your thoughts on this idea, especially because Christo dying in 2020, and that here his legacy is hard to miss. It's right there in the middle of Paris.
I think it's lovely. I can't wait to come see it. I still remember what he did in Central Park, which was stunning. It's a way of altering our expectations. It's a way of disguising things. There are some buildings in Brussels I wish someone would, frankly, come and wrap myself. But this is nice. I mean, there's a sort of Palais of Justice that has been under construction for about 172 years, and that could use a good wrapping.
A good wrapping. Recycled paper, Dana Thomas, says Matthew. And the whole project's self-financed as well.
Well, you know, it's just the perfect sort of posthumous love letter, in a way, to Paris. Christo escaped from the Eastern Bloc and landed in Paris in the late 1950s, and he lived in a Chambre de Bonne overlooking the Arc de Triomphe. And so he just, for him, it was a monument to conquer. He started wrapping this, you know, doing his sculpture wraps in that Chambre de Bonne in Paris while looking at the Arc de Triomphe. He's wrapped it in this beautiful fabric that has pulverized aluminum in it. So it, like you said, with the light, it just changes a silvery blue, but with the sunlight and the sunset and everything, it just changes beautifully. Every pleat perfectly designed, every rope and cord perfectly placed. And he did this, you know, before he died and left it to the city as his adieu. And I think it is just the most poetic and beautiful and complete story he could have done.
It's going to be up till October the 3rd. The roundabout will be closed to the public on weekends, over the next 2 weekends, so everyone can get a closer look.
It reminds me of an elephant.
A toilet paper?
A big toilet paper.
Wait, so is this the actual installation, or are they doing something under it?
So, Nico Hines, are you coming over?
I'd love to. I seem to recall a few weeks ago when I was last in Paris that you and I had an argument about the awful cars that swirl around the Arc de Triomphe. So as far as I'm concerned, it looks great from the pictures. And for me, just the idea of strolling across without all those cars buzzing and burbling and actually appreciating the Arc de Triomphe in its new state, that would be the real win.
All right, you're priming the pump for another discussion, that about the new 30 kilometers an hour speed limit rules in the French capital. Well, unfortunately, we don't have time for that. That is a wrap for us. Nico Hines, I want to thank you for joining us from London. Dana Thomas in Saint-Tropez, Steve Erlinger in Brussels, Matthew Dalton, thank you for being with us here in The World This Week.